Today marks day 26 of the longest government shutdown in history. Good morning. We're live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect. I'm Melissa Ross, and thanks for listening. Just ahead, the shutdown's impact on local families, especially the Coast Guard. Also this hour, Florida's dying film industry and what can be done to save it, and find out why it's easy being green at the beaches this morning. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, more than 40,000 active duty Coast Guard members missed their scheduled paycheck Tuesday as the only military branch to work without pay during the government shutdown. That's because they fall under the Department of Homeland Security at the center of the funding dispute. Now, many members of the Coast Guard civilian workforce have been furloughed as well. Here in our area, there are several hundred Coast Guard families being affected by the shutdown. Shannon Beattie is a local wife and mother whose husband is a Coast Guard officer stationed at Mayport. And she's on the line now with more about how this is affecting her family. Shannon, thanks for being with us. Good morning.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having me.
So your family missed its paycheck, I believe, on Tuesday, like so many other Coast Guard families. Can you tell us a little bit about how the Beattie family is coping?
Yes, ma'am. We did miss receiving our paycheck, unfortunately. I was hopeful that things would work out and it would be in there, but no, there was no deposit. Luckily, we are members of a credit union, Navy Federal, who has stepped in to assist us in covering my husband's pay until the government starts paying us again. So they have been very supportive and helpful for us during this uncertainty and stressful time.
So Navy Federal, are they loaning Coast Guard families money to get them through this, or how is it working?
Essentially, it is a loan, but they're charging no interest. So it's a 0% interest loan. And once the deposits go back, paychecks go back into effect, we will have to repay them.
I see. Now, you and your husband have two little boys, and it's my understanding you have started working, too, to kind of help make ends meet. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. I didn't want to just sit on the sidelines and watch everything unfold, so I went out and started looking for a part-time job, and I landed a seasonal position at Lowe's working in the garden center. So that will be nice to bring in some extra cash for things like after school activities, t-ball, or going out for pizza on Friday night.
Sure. Congratulations. What's the talk like at Mayport and in the surrounding neighborhoods where so many families are being affected by this? As far as I am aware, this is the first time in the nation's history that a branch of our armed forces has not been paid due to a lapse in government appropriations. This is unprecedented. And the Coast Guard, of course, is working without pay, and it's a physically dangerous job as well.
Yeah, I mean, it is a shame that they're expected to report to work as scheduled and not receive a paycheck. It's just mind-boggling to me that the government won't put a plan in place to at least pay the workers. The ripple effect of that is quite scary. I'm sure the morale is pretty low at work, knowing that you have to go and you're not going to get paid, but you still have to put gas in your car. So it takes a little bit of extra oomph to get up in the morning and go to work. But, they're doing what they know they're called to do. And, this is their job. This is their duty. They're honored to serve our country. That's why they signed up.
Including your husband. He's been going to work every day during the shutdown.
Yes, ma'am.
Yeah. And so how hopeful are you that this will be resolved soon? We're in day 26 now. This is the longest such shutdown in American history.
Well, I am a hopeful person. I rely on my faith to carry me through this. But I really couldn't even say. I didn't expect it to go this long. So I hope and pray that it doesn't go to February 1st. But I can't count on that, unfortunately.
Right. Well, here's hoping that you will get that paycheck in the Beattie household very soon. and all of your colleagues out there at Mayport who are in the U.S. Coast Guard family. She's Shannon Beatty, a local wife and mother. Her husband is a Coast Guard officer stationed at Mayport, on the line with us this morning. Shannon, best to you, and thanks for sharing your story.
Okay, thanks. We are having food drives and community drop-offs throughout the beaches area for people that need assistance. You can go to the USO on Mayport on Friday and receive food donations. And we are accepting community drop-offs at Christ United Methodist Church on Pinman on Saturday at 10 o'clock, like gas card donations, diapers, non-perishable food items, things like that.
Thank you so much for that information. We'll get that on our website as well later today, Shannon.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, anyone that would like to donate to help local Coast Guard families, please do that. Call the USO office in Mayport to find out how you can help. USAA, the military insurer, is donating $15 million, meanwhile, to the Coast Guard Mutual Assistance Fund. The Red Cross is starting up a program to help Coast Guard members. As Shannon mentioned, Navy Federal Credit Union and other credit unions around town, by the way, are also trying to help local families any way they can. As yet, the president has been unable to resolve the standoff with Democrats in Congress as he pushes for $5.7 billion for his proposed border wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. That is at the heart of the standoff. Now at day 26. We'll continue to follow this here at 89.9, more on our website later today as well. Well, in other news, Florida was once dubbed Hollywood East. Yeah, thanks to our vibrant film and television industry. This is a great place to shoot productions with our beaches and oceans and sunny weather. However, you may not have realized that the industry has been decimated because the state decided to get rid of its film incentives program a couple of years ago. Here's one question. Could anything change under the new Ron DeSantis administration, or will it be status quo? What status quo means is that most film productions these days are shooting in Georgia, not Florida. Still, though, some filmmakers are pressing on, despite the lack of incentives, like local writer-director Sam Farmer and local producer Jonathan Shepard. They have a new film out this month. It's called Cry for the Bad Man. They're in studio. Sam, John, good morning to you both.
Good morning, Melissa. Thanks for having us.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being with us. And joining us by phone from Orlando, he's John Lux, Executive Director of Film Florida. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good to have you on the show. We did reach out to the Jacksonville Film Commission office. They were unable to appear on the show today, but here is our question to callers. Would you like to see more film and television production return to Florida? It's a clean industry and it generates thousands of jobs. Are you wondering why all the film and television shows have gone away? Does it bother you that they're shooting in Georgia now, not Florida, or not? Give us a call, 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. You can also weigh in on our Facebook page. All right, John Lux, before we talk to our filmmakers here in studio, let's begin with you. Until a couple of years ago, Florida was doing great when it came to attracting movies and television shows to shoot here. What changed? Why did the legislature decide to stop making it attractive for these productions to come to Florida?
Well, that's a great question. Florida, for many, many decades, has had a great film and television industry. The most recent program to entice projects and companies to come to Florida was put in play on the books in 2010, and it lasted until June of 2016. Unfortunately, funding for that program expired or was depleted in about 2014. So it's been a good couple of years that we haven't had any program to entice those projects to come to Florida, despite our efforts to revamp programs and improve them. We just haven't had the luck in Tallahassee. Meanwhile, more than 30 states in America have those programs. We're the only state in the southern region of America, from New Mexico over to Delaware, that doesn't have a program. So in essence, we're almost competing with an arm tied behind our back, and there's almost as if a roadblock in order to get for those projects to get into the state of Florida. So it's a challenge from a sales and marketing perspective to show the value in coming to Florida when a project can go to another neighboring state and get a little bit more value for their dollar.
Right. The recent film, Live by Night, that starred Ben Affleck, it was set in Ybor City, Tampa, but they shot it up in Brunswick, Georgia. I think that was a perfect example of the irony of this. Now, let me ask you about the politics of this. In 2016, the Florida branch of Americans for Prosperity, that's a lobbying group backed by the hard right Koch brothers. They are ideologically opposed to all forms of incentives that target specific industries. They were able to convince the Florida legislature to scrap the Florida Film Incentives Program, you know, giving tax credits essentially to movie and television production. So what are your thoughts about the role of the Koch brothers in Florida's basically now moribund film industry?
Well, we're obviously not pleased that they have that opinion. We don't agree with it, obviously. We believe that if done properly, our industry can meet the minimum requirements for return on investment for the state of Florida, as well as bringing thousands upon thousands of high-paying jobs to our state. The average annual wage for an industry professional working in our industry is $81,000 a year, which is 68% higher than all jobs here in Florida. So we're an industry with the type of jobs that we think can help grow Florida's economy the right way. There's a lot of conversation about wages here in the state. We see ourselves as part of the solution. You know, everybody is entitled to their opinion. We think that there are incorrect assumptions in the Americans for Prosperity argument. They bring up old facts and figures. And so we try to focus on the positives of our stance and the positives of our industry and just talk from that. We really don't try and get into a mudslinging conversation because we don't think that's effective and pushing the ball forward. But obviously we disagree with their stance on things. And, we just kind of try and focus on the positives of what we can bring to the state of Florida.
Okay, let's talk to our filmmakers now in studio. Sam and John, your new production is called Cry for the Bad Man. We'll talk about that in a moment. But first, how difficult is it to get a production going in Florida now, given the fact that incentives are gone? Does it make a difference or not?
It does make a difference. It's just the immediate difference is we've lost our pool of talent. We've had so many people that worked on this project that have relocated to Georgia since then. And there's an unintended consequence if they're a professional actor, if they're SAG-AFTRA. That means that we have to cover their travel now that we would not have otherwise. Like, if we like them enough to cast them in a movie and bring them back down here, then they get portal-to-portal pay. So there's a hidden cost there that you don't consider.
John, I don't think people realize just how much film and television production is up in Georgia now. Just north of Atlanta is my understanding. There's a whole hub of film people there and shows being shot. I've heard they even call it Yollywood. Like y'all. Is that right?
Well, it's not just north of Atlanta. Of course, Atlanta has boomed. And some of the things Atlanta did right was they very quickly, very early in their own incentive program, built an infrastructure. The investment came rather rapidly. It was really a lot of smart investment there that prevented some of the things I think we experienced here in Florida. Not that we didn't have some infrastructure here, but those two things combined allowed a cyclical revenues to stay in the state a little more frequently. It's also in Savannah. Savannah has an incredible film community. It's an it's an attraction for a lot of different looks and feels. And it seems like the only time that truly Florida is used is when it's very so specific, something like Bloodline, where it's the Keys. It's a little tough to fake that.
You can't fake the Keys.
Very many places.
But. Yeah, sure. That was the Netflix show. And it's interesting, too, to note that, of course, Jacksonville was the first Hollywood. The early film producers shot here before they moved out to California. The Norman Silent Film Studios Museum is here. Here are some of the films that have been shot here that you might remember over the years. Basic, Cool Hand Luke, The Manchurian Candidate. The Devil's Advocate, Sunshine State, G.I. Jane, Creature from the Black Lagoon. this incredible variety of films, and some television has been shot here, but not anymore. And you can also think of Miami Vice. That's a famous Florida television show. Can you explain a little bit about why incentives make such a difference? According to Film Florida, Florida has lost over 60 major film and television projects since the legislature did away with incentives. They would have spent, according to Film Florida, more than $1 billion, more than 87,000 cast and crew jobs, more than 160,000 hotel room nights statewide. So it seems as though there's an ancillary effect to investing in this industry.
Absolutely. It makes it, at our level, you know, we're producing independent films, it makes it much more difficult to raise that money initially. It's a little bit more scary, scares them away. To add to the point that you were saying, though, about what we've lost, in just the last few years, we've had Jacksonville-specific plot lines in films that were shot on a studio somewhere. St. John's River, you know, out there where you see the Jacksonville skyline in the background, that's completely, there's a show called Florida Girls that's shot up in Georgia now. It's ridiculous.
And John Lux, as you head up Film Florida, that's got to be frustrating for you.
It's very frustrating. You know, we hear the stories every day from our colleagues that are struggling, and many of them have moved to Georgia, like the guys had mentioned. Sometimes in even worse situations is that husbands and wives are leaving their families for weeks or even months at a time to go elsewhere to work, and literally separating families in order to try and make a living. And we would rather keep those people here, you know, whether it's the 50,000 people that work in our industry, or whether it's the 5,000 students a year that are graduating from our colleges and universities with degrees in our industry. We would rather have them working in our workforce and helping our economy, as opposed to helping Georgia's economy and Texas and Louisiana and states like that. We'd rather keep those folks here at home in our economy. And you had mentioned, you know, a Bloodline was a great example of the impact that a television series or film can have on a community. They did a study, the Tourism Development Council in Monroe County did a study after Bloodline's first season, and found they spent $30 million in the first season just in production spending alone. And then on top of that, they found there was more than $65 million worth of tourism revenue from people that came to the Keys specifically because they saw Bloodline. You know, film and television lasts forever, and it's not a billboard, it's not a print ad, it's not a banner ad. You know, you can go on Netflix now a couple of years after Bloodline aired, and people are still binge watching it and coming to the Keys because of it. So the overall economic impact of our industry is enormous, and it's something that it's very frustrating to see, you know, a record $2.7 billion spent in Georgia last year, knowing that a good portion of that probably could have been done right here in our state.
All right, let's go to some of your calls as we talk about film and television production driving right up I-95 to Georgia and leaving Florida. In a moment, we'll talk about the premiere of a new local film, though, Cry for the Bad Man, that was successfully made. It's 549-2937 to join us. David is in Jacksonville Beach. Hi, David. Good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead.
I just wanted to reiterate the point. I work in the industry, and just how important it is. The movies go where the rebates are. You know, Pirates of the Caribbean 5 that I worked on went to Australia for no other reason than they got something like 36% back in tax rebates on their money. There was no reason to go there. The Warner Brothers stuff that's being shot in London, it's all there just because the rebates are there and they can go there. They will go where they can get, where it's cheapest for them to do it. And if we want a film industry in Florida, we have to get that rebate, because there's no other way that they're gonna come here.
So, David, do you do a lot of traveling then as well?
A lot of traveling, yeah.
And what do you do? What's your job?
I'm. It's kind of a weird job. I'm a helicopter pilot. I fly, you know, I fly helicopters in the movies, but 80%, 90% of the work is with a camera attached to the helicopter.
So you're the guy getting those great aerial shots in movies. Is that it?
Yeah.
What a fun job.
Sometimes.
Sometimes.
The whole travel thing, I mean, you know, they fly you to Australia for one day shooting. And it's crazy, you know, this stuff could be done in the States, but
I see.
If they get the rebates, that's where they're going to go. That's where the producers, are going to take their movies.
Okay. I got you, David. Thanks for that. That's David in Jacksonville Beach. Here's another point of view. Joe emails the show. Well, how much tax money are we talking about? That money could be used to help poor communities. Filmmaking is not going to bring sustainable jobs to Florida. John, what about the argument that the legislature bought, which is, well, we just can't afford these incentives and it's not worth it?
Well, I think there has to be a major rethinking of these incentives. There's a lot of, you know, copycat incentives popping up state to state. And they're a little more traditional. Georgia has reshaped it. Like I said earlier, they reinvested in infrastructure and tied that to some of the investment. The money follows the investment. So for investors to invest, whether it's a studio from outside or whether it's someone in Florida who wants to see Florida prosper in the film industry, I think we have to break the mold a little bit. I'd like to see Florida maybe strike a new way of thinking of incenting films not only to be here, to come here and use our talent and use our backdrops, but also a way to keep some of that money here. Because if we don't build the industry from these little independent films all the way up through the major studios, we're leaving out a major pocket of the filmmaking community. And not only that, we're not building a future. We're not leaving anything back behind for the future to build on. It's a lot more detailed than what I'm able to describe here in a few seconds, but I think there has to be a rethink of how do we get investors, even locally, how Florida investors to invest in Florida film, to see those films come to fruition, to see those films get distribution, because it's not like art collection. It is an art form in its making, but then it becomes a commoditized tangible after that, and that can have increasing returns or it can have diminishing returns. We have to rethink what those incentives are and what we're doing with them along the way, not just can we get a big movie here, incentivize them to make it here, and then take it back and make their money elsewhere.
Douglas is in Duval County. Hello, Douglas. Go ahead.
Good morning.
Good morning. Oh. Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was kind of involved with the infancy of the film industry in the late 80s, in 1989, when Universal Studios and Disney MGM Studios opened up and Hollywood East was going to be Orlando. And I owned a modeling and talent agency, was an entertainment lawyer, represented a number of production companies. And at that time, we were on par with Georgia, probably we were ahead of Georgia as far as production during the early 90s. And we gave incentives, Georgia gave incentives, and the thing that Georgia has done in the past probably 7 to 8 years is they created an investment opportunity where they went to the Georgia legislature, turned those tax incentives, those tax credits that were being given to production companies, into transferable commodities. And what happened is these investment companies would come in and they would pay the production companies cash for their tax credits, and then they would create these, you know, funds that people could invest in, and it would be paying them on, you know, from that. And it was the way that the production companies were able to get immediate money rather than wait for tax credits really became a very, very attractive thing for those production companies. And you could see the major shift where everything went to Georgia, and then, of course, we lost our incentives, and it just all fell apart. So I just wanted to make a comment and give
and
you
so you got out of that line of work then, it sounds like.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Thanks for sharing that, Douglas. Sorry to hear that. Tony is on the south side. Hey, Tony, thanks for holding. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for having me on. So I'm a student at FSCJ studying broadcast technology and video production. And, you know, we have a lot of really neat little film festivals here. Had the 48-Hour Film Festival, and there's one that supports the St. John's Riverkeeper. And, you know, there are some really great small opportunities, but as soon as I graduate, I'm looking to get out of the state because, you know, I want to make it big. I'm looking for that big, awesome, you know, career opportunity to create some amazing art and to be a part of something really big. And I'm probably going to have to go to Georgia or somewhere else. I don't feel as if that opportunity as a broadcast sort of producer is here for anything really outside of news and sort of mid or low level production. So I feel like that's going to take me away. But if we had more of the industry here, I would definitely be more inclined to stay because I'm a Florida boy. I love it here.
Right. Yeah. You'd rather stay. Sure. Well, yep. I'm sorry to hear that, and good luck, Tony. Sam Farmer, the website Film Hub, is noting the fact that Georgia is taking over the TV and film business. There are 50 movies and television shows, 50, shooting in Georgia right now. All kinds of films.
Marvel movies.
The Marvel movies.
Walking Dead.
The Walking Dead, which is a really popular television show. Dozens of productions up in Georgia. That's got to kill you.
Well, again, you know, for what we do here, we're happy to produce in Florida. Much like the last caller, we enjoy the environment here. It's just, it would be nice if there was some give and take, you know. And so the biggest struggle for us is that we just keep losing our pool of talent. We're losing grip. We're losing cameramen. We're losing sound guys. We're losing acting talent. It's all going to Georgia.
Okay, John Lux of Film Florida still on the line with us. Here's another email. Your guests are calling this incentives. If it was any other industry, it would be called crony capitalism, and it would be said with a distasteful flavor. So is the push to get film incentives back crony capitalism? John Lux.
No, it definitely isn't. And the reason is that we can show the proven, the return on investment. So, you know, we've been working very closely with a number of different groups, one of which is Florida Tax Watch, which is an independent nonprofit watchdog group. It's their job to basically call out crony capitalism. And they just released a report, and specific in their press release, it says state policymakers should strongly consider a fiscally responsible program to help grow targeted industries such as film and television production. You know, and that's where we're at. You know, a giveaway is when somebody gives something away. In our case, we have pieces of legislation that would show that for every $1 that the state would give our industry, we would give the state $1 back in tax revenues on top of the thousands of high-paying jobs that we would produce. So when someone says, well, I don't want to necessarily give money to this industry because we need it more in that industry or that sector, to us, it's a yes and situation. You know, a way to grow the economy is to do this with our industry and still have that money that you get back from the program, the targeted program, to go towards another sector of the economy. So we would completely disregard someone that says it's crony capitalism because we can show them that it's good for the economy, it's good for Floridians. You know, we're not just talking about, you know, grips and camera people and lighting techs and producers. When a project comes to an area, they eat in restaurants. That helps those that work in that industry. They stay in hotels and resorts. They buy lumber at Home Depot and Lowe's and hardware stores. They hire electricians and plumbers and off-duty police officers to work security. So we touch so many different aspects of the economy here in the state that I think any argument of calling it crony capitalism or corporate welfare is just using a good buzz term, but it really isn't the reality of the situation when it comes to working with our industry, because we can show the return on investment if done properly.
Okay. And with all of that said, Sam Farmer, John Shepherd, you are debuting a new film this weekend at Sunray Cinema. It's called Cry for the Bad Man. Tell us quickly about it.
Cry for the Bad Man is a home invasion thriller patterned after a Western. It's very classic. We have a B-movie scream queen in it, Camille Keaton, best known for her work in the 1979 revenge exploitation film, I Spit on Your Grave.
Oh, yeah, of course.
She will be here at the screening. We're almost sold out, though, so if anybody is interested in that, this is likely going to be the only local screening before we hit the festival and convention run this year.
That's exciting.
And I think it's a real testament. Sam's a very talented writer and director and just an artist in general that I've had the privilege of working with for a number of years now. And it's just one small example, if you will, of what great talent is still here and can be sought out. Has nothing to do with tax incentives for the cronyism commentator, but it really has to do with the generosity. It was made through the generosity of a few small investors and a crew who invested much of their time, their life, their energy, and their amazing talent. It's here. The talent is here. We don't want to go elsewhere. We want to make these things here, and we want to see more of this made here. Fortunately, there's a lot of grassroots groups, including individuals like ourselves here, that are keeping this alive. And it's great to see the quality, even at a very low price, I guess you could say, that has come out of the Sam's direction and everything about the film. Is much higher in value than it is for what was invested.
Did a lot with a small budget. So get your tickets now before it sells out to see the new independent film Cry for the Bad Man, starring I Spit on Your Grave star
Camille Keaton.
This is Saturday night at Sunray Cinema. He is writer, director Sam Farmer and producer Jonathan Shepard, both in studio. Guys, good to have you. And joining us by phone from Central Florida, John Lux, executive director of Film Florida. John, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, guys. Have a great premiere. And up next, why it's so easy to go green at the beaches. This is First Coast Connect. Back in a moment.
I'm Jessica Palumbo. Every Thursday, I host The Jackson on WJCT.
We actually have some pretty great public spaces here in Jacksonville.
Jacksonville is still trying to wrap its head around clustering.
The urban core was Jacksonville's original city limits before consolidation in 1968.
Tomorrow during Morning Edition here on 89.9.
Support for The Jackson on WJCT comes from the Jacksonville Police and Fire Pension Fund.
That sound means you're in the Electro Lounge, where fresh, down-tempo, chill-out, and new jazz music plays Monday through Saturday nights at 9 p.m. only on 89.9 FM WJCT.
This Going Green segment is made possible by A1A Solar.
Welcome back. Well, an effort to reduce, reuse, and recycle is really gaining steam this year at the beaches. Anne Marie Moquin is founder and executive director of Beaches Go Green, and she's here in studio. Hey, good morning.
Good morning.
You know, we regularly focus on sustainability on this program, so it's exciting to hear more about Beaches Go Green. You founded this just a few months ago. It's taken off. What's it all about?
We founded Beaches Go Green in June of 2018, and how it started is some friends and I wanted to find a way that we could give back to the community, and we watched a documentary, which I highly recommend. It's called The Plastic Ocean, and we couldn't believe how widespread and how dangerous the problems of plastic in the ocean and plastic in the environment. And I've always been really passionate about animals. And so to see the animals suffering after they ate the plastic, you know, on purpose or by accident, just really stuck with me. And I thought that if people knew more about it and we just made it more highly visible, that people would want to make changes on their own to make the problem better.
Yeah. And there are so many easy ways we can encourage business to move in this direction of making less packaging, making less single-use plastic and styrofoam, beginning by just not buying them, refusing. So we used to say reduce, reuse, recycle. Now you say it's refuse, reduce, reuse, and recycle. So how do we refuse?
Absolutely. So our theme for this year is the four R's, the refuse, reduce, reuse, recycle. And first, we ask people to consider refusing anything single use. If you're only going to use it one time, is there a better way to do it? Can you have something that's reusable, or can you use something that you already have? So that's
like
the
your
first.
Own coffee mug, for example.
Absolutely.
So rather that's than the first. Getting a Starbucks paper one.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the first step, refuse. And then reduce. As a consumer, you can vote with your money. So look for products that have less plastic packaging and less packaging in general. You can buy in bulk. There are lots of things that you can do also to decrease your ecological footprint. You could ride your bike instead of drive your car. There's lots of things we can do. We can compost and give back to the earth. So an interesting statistic is 40% of all the plastic used is in packaging. So packaging is a big deal. So definitely reduce. And then reuse is an easy one. I think there's a big movement coming encouraging people to bring your own, right? Mm-hmm. BYO, water bottles and bags at the grocery store and at shopping, straws and so on.
Straws are really big. Now, and this is something that I think kids are forcing their parents to do. And that's certainly true in my own house.
Okay.
You know, because I think of myself as pretty environmentally aware, but I was unthinkingly using straws every time I would go somewhere to eat.
Sure.
My daughters scolded me and insisted that we start using reusable straws.
That's great.
They do not want reusable straws anywhere near themselves because, you know, they're much more aware of this than their generation is than all of us adults. So just as they were scolding me about this, I received a holiday gift in the mail from Oceana, and it was stainless steel straws.
Nice.
And a little brush cleaner to clean the straws, because straws do a lot of damage to plant life and animal life in the ocean. Can
they
you
really
talk a little
do.
Bit about that?
So so straws and a lot of the single-use plastic ends up in the ocean. And if you don't know this, plastic never breaks down. It's petroleum-based, and it breaks up into tiny or smaller pieces of plastic called microplastics and nanoplastics. And what makes those so dangerous is that the molecules are jagged, and they attract toxins that are floating in the water. So what that means is that animals, you know, microorganisms and even bigger organisms, when they eat pieces of plastic, they're basically eating poison pills. And
eventually we eat the plastic.
Absolutely.
The food chain works its way back to us.
Absolutely. And I wanted to add to that. So we've learned that, at least we believe that the plastic itself isn't migrating necessarily from the gut into the meat that we might eat, but those toxins that are attached to the plastic are. And so we're definitely getting, unfortunately, those toxins in our food.
Right. And so we can all reduce this by our choices.
Absolutely.
So we've talked about refusing single-use plastics, reducing the amount of waste we generate, reusing things we have. Like, don't do plastic bags at Publix. Just don't do it. Get the cloth bags.
Sure.
Put them in the back of your car and use them when you go to buy groceries. That's what I do. I've been doing that for years. It's not hard to do. Plastic bags do a lot of damage. Get a reusable coffee mug and ask your barista to use it. Get reusable straws. Last on the list by design, recycling.
Recycling, yes. So recycling is an amazing thing, and I would never discourage somebody from recycling. I'm definitely pro-recycling. I just want to encourage people, before they get to the point of having to recycle, to reduce the amount of waste that they're producing. Recycling has undergone some massive changes in the last year. Some of the countries overseas, especially China, that were originally taking our recyclable materials, they were purchasing purchasing them from the recycling sorting companies are no longer doing that. And the recycling companies here were paid a premium at that time, and now they're forced to sell the materials domestically in the U.S., and they're not getting as much money. And there's also an overabundance of these materials, which of course drives down the price. So the recycling industry is going through a lot of changes, and in some ways, it's a little bit uncertain. There are some cities, even as close as Ormond Beach and in Deltona, that have suspended their recycling programs because it's cost prohibitive. So eventually, if we're going to be good partners to our recycling companies, we need to look at the contracts and the agreements and make it a win situation for both in order to keep recycling going, even if it is just 9 or 10% of all.
I gotcha. Okay. Now, we need to point out that Beaches Go Green is the official green partner of the upcoming Donna Marathon.
You'll be raising awareness.
You'll be setting up recycling stations and doing a lot of other things at the big race. You also just closed out your very first green survey at the beaches. And you're presenting those results next week at the City of Atlantic Beach Commission meeting. What's happening?
We're very excited about this meeting. So January 23rd, a week from today at 6 p.m. at the Atlantic Beach Commission Chamber, we'll be having a sustainability meeting. We'll have the mayors from Neptune Beach and Atlantic Beach. We'll have several elected officials, representatives from Republic Services, our local recycle sorting plant will be there. And we're going to discuss, you know, what the community told us in the survey, where they want to learn and where they want the focus to be. And then announce plans moving forward for sustainability at the beach. And we hope to grow out past Atlantic and Neptune. We're just starting there and creating a best case, get best practices and go forward from there.
Excellent. That's coming up next week. I also want to make a quick note of something in Jacksonville. The North Florida Green Chamber is launching this year in the city. Their launch party is this Thursday night at MOSH, the Museum of Science and History, in downtown Jacksonville at 6:30 p.m. You can RSVP to that at northfloridagreenchamber.org/events. Again, that's the launch of the North Florida Green Chamber. And out at the beaches, Beaches Go Green, come on out next week to their big announcement at Atlantic Beaches Commission Chambers. And you'll see them as well at the Donna Marathon coming up in February. So, Anne-Marie Moquin, kudos to you.
Thank you.
Thanks for going green with us on this show. We appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much.
All right. A quick break. And in a moment, have you heard about the Lantern Parade? This is the coolest thing ever. And the second annual one is coming up in Jacksonville very, very soon. If you think you can't be part of this, you actually can. You can make your own lantern, and we are going to tell you how to do that in just a moment here on First Coast Connect. So don't go away. Keep listening.
The Pontevedra Concert Hall presents stand-up comedian Robert Klein on Sunday, January 20th. For nearly 40 years, Klein's observational comedy has won over crowds and landed him roles on Broadway, film, and television. Tickets for Robert Klein at Ticketmaster.com.
The City of Jacksonville invites you to the 32nd Annual Martin Luther King Jr. Breakfast presented by Florida Blue with inspirational speaker Chris Gardner. Friday, January 18th at 7 a.m. at the Prime Osborne Convention Center. Information at jacksmlkbreakfast.com.
What does it cost to keep the government closed?
A longer shutdown is something we haven't had. If we have an extended shutdown, then I do think that that would show up in the data pretty clearly.
The Federal Reserve Chairman warns of the economic impact of the federal freeze and will explore those costs. That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI.
Weekdays at 2 on 89.9 WJCT.
In Texas's biggest county, a record 19 elected judges are bringing Black Girl Magic to the bench.
Just the idea of Black Girl Magic in and of itself is just a celebration of the accomplishments of African-American women in various sectors within society, and typically those where we're underrepresented.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly. Harris County's big step towards representation. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today at 4 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Keep calm and carry on, a popular slogan for the British in World War II. How's that working with Brexit? More than a million Americans work for British companies. What does Britain leaving the European Union mean for those workers and for America's relationship with Europe? Next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, you can be part of the second annual Jacksonville Lantern Parade coming up next month, and you can even make your own lantern for this. Now, if you've never heard about the Lantern Parade, you're in luck. We're going to hear all about it now from the organizer. He's Joe White, publisher of Jacksonville Magazine. Joe, good to see you.
Good to see you, Melissa.
Now, you created this last year. It was inspired by a huge event in Atlanta. They have a lantern parade that tens of thousands of people go to, and you saw that and thought, we should be doing this here. Last year, you almost got rained out, but it went off in the end without a hitch, so that was great.
We had terrible weather, but it did turn out, and we had about 2,000 people show up, and I thought nobody was coming, but they came, so that was fantastic.
That just shows the demand. So here we are again. It's the second annual lantern parade. This is going to be happening February 16th, and people are going to walk along the North Bank Riverwalk from the Riverside Arts Market all the way to the Jacksonville Landing.
Yes.
But they're going to be carrying these incredible, beautiful Chinese lanterns, paper lanterns.
Paper lanterns of all shapes and sizes. We had students who made things like they made a giant Starbucks cup that lit up. We had an artist who made a shark that was about 6 feet long that rolled along. You can make anything that you want. It doesn't have to be an Asian theme. We want you to bring anything. The Kummer Museum hosted a workshop that they made parasols that lit up. And so
anything that lights up at night.
Anything goes. The one thing is people ask, you cannot release them. There are no live flames and they will not be released into the air. That's actually prohibited in the state of Florida. So you have to hold on to
too
it.
Too bad.
Well, environmental reasons.
It would create a lot of pollution.
Yes, you can't do that.
Okay, so leading up to the big parade, you actually are here today to get the word out about some lantern making workshops that are going to be happening.
Yeah, so people can go to stores or online and buy them, but we have a whole series of workshops that I'll be hosting at some of the craft breweries in town. Our presenting sponsor, Vistar, is hosting a series of workshops. The library has a series of workshops, so you can go to our website and see when those are happening. But you don't have to necessarily even go to a workshop. You can do it at your house go to our site. You can see examples of what people have made in the past. So,
and the website is?
JacksonvilleLanternParade.com.
You brought a couple of these with you here to the studio this morning. We'll have some pictures on our website.
Yes.
They're beautiful, big, round, colorful paper lanterns.
Those are for you. So we want
you
to come out.
Thank you. Now, how about this too? You've raised enough money for this to donate some art equipment to local schools, including La Villa School of the Arts.
Yeah. So people always ask me that why do this? And my first answer is, well, because it'll be fun. And I think the city could benefit from something like this because it's downtown. It shows off the river and all the things that we like about living here. But it does have a larger mission being the charitable side to it. And because of our sponsors, Vistar, Wolfson, Children's Hospital, and Haskell, we're able to donate equipment. For example, you mentioned La Villa. We were able to raise money that Haskell donated two 3D printers to the school, which they hadn't had before. We're donating a pottery kiln to an elementary school. And we'll be donating a piece of equipment for the theater department at Douglas Anderson, too. So
you know, it has a nice meaning behind it. But I tell people, if you just come out and have a good time, that's fine too. We're happy for you to do that.
We are radio, so let's just create a picture in people's minds now of what this will look like the night of February 16th, when, let's hope, thousands and thousands of people all amass on the North Bank Riverwalk and create a parade of light.
We're going to have we have at least four bands that will be performing in it. We're going to have some laser light displays. There'll be fireworks at 9 o'clock at the conclusion of it. Food trucks, family games. So there's a whole series of attractions and things to enjoy along the way. But I think, knock on wood, that the weather's nice. It'll just be a beautiful thing to see.
And hopefully, I'm assuming you're going to get some aerial photos, maybe some drone footage of what this might look like along the river.
Yes, we'll be having photographers there taking video and pictures. We've asked people not to go crazy flying drones all over the place because we don't want too much of that. Mm-hmm. But certainly anybody wants to come down, take pictures, have fun.
It's such a great idea, and I'm so glad it's continuing. It's going to be bigger and better than ever this year. So mark your calendar for the second annual Jacksonville Lantern Parade coming up February 16th. You're going to assemble at the Riverside Arts Market starting at...
The market will be open at 5. That's when the food trucks and everybody will be set up. The parade itself starts at 7.
7 p.m.
9 o'clock is when it ends, fireworks.
Okay. And if you want to make a lantern yourself, go to JacksonvilleLanternParade.com to sign up for a workshop to really do something fun. And bring your kids, too, because they're going to love this, I promise you.
Absolutely.
Joe White, publisher-editor of Jacksonville Magazine, spearheaded the Lantern Parade again this year. So kudos, Joe, and I'll see you there.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right. And let's hope for good weather as well.
Yes, yes, please, please.
That is our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Heather Schatz. Michelle Corum is our director. And we always want your feedback. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. And if you missed anything from this morning's show, catch our rebroadcast tonight at 8 o'clock. If you're listening to that rebroadcast, keep listening for music. 1A is up next. I'm Melissa Ross. We'll be back at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.